accession number 19775, reel 2.
Colonel Massey, reel 2.
The big danger people saw as being communism, and Hitler and Mussolini were an antidote to communism, so that possibly they didn't take enough precautions when Hitler started rearming and mucking people about generally. But I was home on leave in 1936, and a friend of my mother's had German relations, one of whom was an 18-year-old girl who was staying in the house, who was one of the Hitler youth. And she used to tell me that when there was a war, the Germans were bound to win it. And it began to dawn on me that that the Germans wanted a war, at least this girl did. So when I was on leave, I happened to break my leg hunting in Ireland, said I got an extra 2 months leave, which upset my stepfather, who was in the War Office, who thought that I had too much leave anyway. And he kindly arranged for me to go on a D&M course, driving a maintenance course at Aldershot, in case hots and sauce were mechanized. And I walked down Pall Mall to Wilkinson's and bought myself a nice to balanced saber, in case we weren't. I then felt ready for the coming conflict.
Where were you when Neville Chamberlain declared war on Germany?
I was in Lorelei on a Sunday. We used to go to a pool of water about 6 feet long, which came out of a rock in a biblical way. Myself and two or three other junior officers used to go there for a picnic, and we were lying there pretending it was cool, which it wasn't, when we saw a peck of dust coming along the road. Turned out to be a bicyclist riding very fast, and was the Mess Davidar, Gundaram. Saab, Saab, war's been declared. So we hurried back to put the mob scheme into action, which chiefly consisted of sharpening our sabres. And nothing happened, nobody wanted us. The Indian Army, of course, was not wanted at that time because nobody saw the war escalating the way it did. And anyway, the Indian Army was really only equipped and trained for fighting on the frontier and for internal security, stopping Muslims and Hindus killing each other.
Lorelei is Balochistan? Lorelei is in Balochistan?
It's a Bojes station in Balochistan, which is one of the entries into India through the Bolan Pass, and Lorelei is a backup to the defense of the Bolan Pass, which nobody took very seriously because nobody thought the Persians were likely to attack India.
But you weren't still in Hodson's Horse by then.
Yes, I was still in Hodson's Horse. I was adjutant, actually. And from there we moved to Meerut. And we were told we were going to mechanize, and indeed our horses were gradually removed from us. We had our last mounted parade in 1940. And we had nothing to train on except the few officers' cars there were and some native buses which one hired, which always broke down, a couple of Austin 7 scout cars which Mervyn Vigers had bought with mess funds because they were being tested by two British cavalry regiments in Aldershot, and he thought they'd be useful in India. And indeed they were, because we had a cadre of drivers, which nobody else had, who could at least drive an Austin 7. It was funny the way Mervyn, in those days, used the officers' mess funds very much for the regiment rather than for the officers. For instance, we had two camels. in those days, you never used the telephone for anything unless it was an emergency. An emergency had to be a war. If you had a message to send, you didn't put it down to the taxpayer by using the telephone. You sent a chit with a horseman to brigade headquarters or wherever it was, because this cost nothing. But Merlin didn't like his horses being out in the sun in the hot weather, losing condition. So the officer's mess bought two camels, and these were what we used for taking messages round the brigade.
How long did you stay with Hodson's horse for?
Well, I got married in 1941. I met a girl coming back from leave who was an Australian, lived in Melbourne, but she wasn't of age, and her parents disliked India. Dirty place, her father said, and he was right. And so eventually they said we could get engaged and we could get married if I went to Australia, which I obviously couldn't do in the middle of a war. So the only thing to do was for her to come to India. So she borrowed £1,000 off her brother-in-law and arrived in Gwalior by the flying boat, which was what operated then. It was 3 years since we'd met, and I wondered if I'd recognize her when I went down to meet her. And I was rather indignant because she had a return ticket. However, we got married 3 days later, and I thought at the time that I'd have 6 months wedded bliss before anything more happened, because it was going to take that amount of time to get mechanized. We hadn't even got any tanks yet. Now, that was March 1941. But in June 1941, Saddam Hussein's predecessors thought the English were going to lose the war, as well they might after Dunkirk and other things. And so they toppled the pro-English king, and we had a problem in Iraq. There were no troops available other than the Merritt Cavalry Brigade, which strengthened itself by calling itself the 2nd Indian Armoured Brigade. It was the 1420th Hussars and the only available light tanks there were. The other two regiments, Hodson's Horse and the 18th Cavalry, hadn't even got horses, they'd gone. So they were replaced by two Gurkha battalions and 3-ton trucks. And off we went to Bombay, got on the boat and went to Basra. And my wife went back to Melbourne with great difficulty, because of course there weren't any commercial planes or ships then. I was the staff captain of the brigade, because the proper staff captain had gone off his head and had been stuffing the office mail under the carpet. So the brigadier came along and asked for me to take his place. So I found myself staff captain of this scratch. Sorry, this scratch force. And we went to Baghdad, which was, I think, sensible in view of subsequent wars in Iraq. And later we attacked the Iranians. And I ended up in Tehran, where I was told to go back to India to take part in the staff college course.
Do you remember the number of the brigade that was sent to the Near East?
2nd Indian Armoured Brigade.
So you were saying you returned to India for staff college at Quetta, was it?
Yes, at Quetta. I sent a cable to my wife in Melbourne, saying, Meacham, Great Eastern Hotel, Calcutta, 1st of January. I got there easy enough. It wasn't so easy for her because the Japanese, of course, had entered the war by now. And she eventually found a Dutch cargo ship which was going to Singapore and got on there. And she was being bombed by the Japanese in Raffles Hotel. It was actually on the last aeroplane out, the one before and the one behind being shot down. And she eventually arrived in Great Eastern in Calcutta on the 2nd of January, a day later, as I pointed out. And from there we went to Quetta for the staff college, where they were doing a two-year course in 6 months, which meant fairly hard work. At the end of it, I got posted to the military training directorate of GHQ India, which in peacetime would have been a good job, but it was a long way from the war. And it was in Simla, where we were very happy, in a little house in Mashobra. And we were there during the winter, and it was very beautiful. But it was a long way from the war. Eventually I managed to get to Delhi, and from there the only way of getting back into the war was to transfer into the infantry, who were short of officers. So I did this and went and joined the 5th, 10th Baluch Regiment in Bombay, where they were doing training with a view to a combined operation capturing Rangoon. I'd been there a week before. We were told that we couldn't have any landing craft because they all wanted for Europe. And if we wanted to get to Rangoon, we'd have to walk. So overnight, the Baluchis lost their vehicles, and they had been a highly mechanized battalion. They were given mules instead, which led to cheap quips about the cavalry officer arriving just in time. And we were on our way to Burma by slow train to Calcutta, up the Brahmaputra, along the very hairy mountain road to Imphal, and thence across the Chinwin. And our walk south began just before Christmas, and we walked along to Shwe Bo, where we crossed the Irrawaddy. We'd been fighting the Japanese rearguard actions all the way. It hadn't been particularly arduous, the odd casualty here and there. But at Shwe, the river near Shwe Bo, where we crossed it one night, the Irrawaddy is a very wide river, but you can hardly see the other bank. And crossing it at night, waiting for machine guns to open up on you, is not really for those of a nervous disposition. And I found it very frightening. However, we got to the other side without any incident. And we formed a brigade bridgehead, which was overlooked by a feature called Pear Hill because the contours were in the shape of a pear. We were there with the Worcesters, the the Worcesters, the Punjabis and the Baluchis. Pear Hill overlooked this bridgehead and was obviously an embarrassing feature. A company of the Baluchis, under Alan Rayleigh, a 22-year-old company commander, whose men followed him anywhere, trying to get ahead of him so that he wouldn't get killed, went out, were sent out on a reconnaissance, found the hill held only by a Japanese officer, warrant officer and private soldier, so they captured it. So I was sent off with another company to consolidate the hill in our possession. When I got there, it was a bit too big for just two companies, but we had a lot of artillery support. So I arranged my soldiers around the fat part of the path and used a lot of deer fire to deal with the stem, as it were. We run Power Hill for 9 days, being attacked by the Japanese who wanted it back. The Baluchis were magnificent. We had quite a lot of casualties. And after 9 days we were relieved, and the Punjab battalion took over from us. We came back from Power Hill, and we proceeded in due course towards Mandalay. About now, the commanding officer, Bob Prince, feet gave out on him and I got command of the battalion. In Mandalay, we ambushed a fleet of Japanese vehicles, which were enormous Fargo trucks, which were very welcome because we were very, very short of transport, just having 12 jeeps and trailers and our mules. So of the 12 Fargo trucks which we captured, we sent 6 on to higher authority and kept 5 ourselves, 1 for each company and 1 for the mess, which we fitted up with furniture, and we went about like a palace after that. The other thing which made life easier was I had somewhere to cart a bath about in, which was a 40-gallon drum cut down long ways and the ends turned over. And really, life was almost civilized. I also had a small Shan pony, which I captured off a Japanese officer, which carried my orderly in my pack and made life a lot easier. We went on to Mandalay. From Mandalay, we went on down the river. By this time we reached the Satang, having various battles along the way of no particular interest, until we got to Tonggu, when the atom bomb fell and the war ended.
What was the composition of the your battalion of the Baluch regiment? I think it was the 5th 10th, wasn't it?
Yep.
What kind of men did you have in it?
There were 2 companies of Punjabi Muslims, 1 of Hindu Dogras, and 1 of Pathans. I hadn't served with Pathans before, and found them absolutely magnificent. They were extraordinary on hills, of course. I remember one occasion we reached the top of a hill and the Japanese were retiring fairly leisurely down it, and I watched with amusement as 2 corporals, Pathan corporals, each leading their section, followed the Japs down the hill like an avalanche, screaming at each other, "Leave them, they're mine." And then it was a dead heat, and the Japanese came off worse. When we got to Tonggu and the war ended, it was all right for the British soldiers who were looking forward to repat, but my soldiers kept on saying, does this mean we've got to go back to India? Because they'd rather enjoyed the war in Burma. It can be quite enjoyable as long as you're on the winning side, of course. Now Burma was in a mess. If you live in Burma, you're either a policeman or a dacoit, thief. There's no middle course, or there wasn't then. And there were plenty of weapons available for the dacoits to use. So my battalion was sent off into an area about the size of Wales to catch one particularly large and tiresome dacoit gang. And of course, as soon as the war ended, we were no longer on air supply, which was too expensive, and I was issued with some elephants instead. I never had any training in the use of elephants up to then, and they tend to slow things down when you've been used to being on airdrops. However, we managed to kill the dacoit second in command and bottled up the dacoit chief when a message arrived for me to report to divisional headquarters. It took me 4 days to get out of the jungle. I finally met up with my general, Pete Rees. Said, what have I done wrong? He said, it must be something awful. There's a message from Delhi, from the commander-in-chief, demanding your presence there straight away. And there's another one being followed from the viceroy saying, where's Mercy? You better get cracking. So I hurried off to Delhi. My wife, who had joined the WASBIS, the Women's Auxiliary Service Burma, some months before and had become its adjutant, had been off to Australia on a recruiting tour and had just finished that when the war ended, and saying that she could now leave soldiering to the professionals, retired straight away and went to Delhi, where she was staying with the surgeon to the viceroy. I went there and said, what's all the fuss about? And she said, they've asked me if you would like to command the bodyguard. And I said, they'd better ask you. So I saw Douglas Curry, the secretary to the viceroy, that day and said yes, and took over the bodyguard, which is perhaps, or was, one of the best commands for a junior officer in the Indian Cavalry. Rest now. On VJ Day, the bodyguard were the airborne squadron to the airborne people who were going to attack Rangoon, but this was stopped by the end of the war, of course. They hadn't been on their horses for 3 years when they came back to Delhi, and I had to get them back into their pre-war into the pre-war ceremonial position, which wasn't easy to do in a hurry. I was aided by an equitation cadre at the remount depot at Mona for men who were to become remount riders and recruit instructors, and I took 2 rides myself in Delhi. I had been on the equitation course at Sorgha before the war. Indeed, I was on the last course. So I quite enjoyed taking equitation rides. In fact, I've always enjoyed training recruits and remounts on horses. We eventually got ourselves sorted out in time for the wedding of the Viceroy's daughter, happened to the first time that bodyguard appeared in full dress since the war. Once we appeared like this, there's a big demand for us to take part in all functions of state. Lord Wavell left, Lord Mountbatten took his place. Then words gave way to deeds, and the selfishness and the vanity, greed, and ignorance of politicians took over. And eventually, the independence was declared in August, whereupon all hell broke loose in the Punjab, where the line between Pakistan and Hindu India was argued against by the Sikhs. An enormous number of people were killed on both sides. The bodyguard was made up of two troops of Mohammedans and two troops of Sikhs. So it really wasn't the best composition for what was going on in northern India. But we never had any trouble. The men, or rather the VCOs, were quite brilliant in their leadership. Early on, I had a Durbar, which all the men attended, in which we agreed that communal riots did nobody any good, and I laid down that in future, when any man left the lines on duty, he would be accompanied by a member of the other community, and each would be responsible for the safety of the other. They had some fairly hairy incidents when Sikhs or Mohammedans would approach one or the other to bump off his companion, and they always came to each other's rescue. It was really quite impressive. But eventually, the Sikh had been on leave and returned to Delhi station, where he went up to an Indian commissioned officer who had a staff car, saluted and asked for a lift to New Delhi. The officer looked at him, and he was wearing the distinctive dress of the bodyguard, which was a maroon pagri for being paratroopers. And he said, "No, the bodyguard are a disgrace to their religion. You consort with Mohammedans and help them instead of destroying them. Wouldn't dream of giving you a lift." So the trooper found his way back to the bodyguard, where he reported this to his troop leader, who told the Rissaldar Major, who came straight along to see me. I saw Mountbatten as quickly as possible and said the Mohammedans must go to Pakistan, because it wasn't fair to keep them here anymore. The VCOs had a farewell parade, which was rather touching. The unit formed up in front of the Viceroy's house, and the two separate echelons gave each other a salute and then did a lift.